chapel and we're gonna get married. Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married. We are really
from 1964 with Chapel of Love. It's just here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, weekly blog talk radio show with your show host Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we want to be talking about the recently enacted Respect for Marriage Act signed into law by President Joe Biden last December 13th. And this law now codifies the Supreme Court's 2015 Obergefell decision saying that marriage is redefined to include homosexual relationships. And to analyze this sort of brave new sexual world order or disorder, perhaps, we want to discuss with ex-gay leader Andrew Kaminsky, who is author of the insightful book from Sophia Institute Press, Rediscovering Our Lost Fullness, A Guide to Sexual Integration. And we want to look at issues of whether this is all that's cracked up to be, that same-sex attracted individuals, homosexuals, are just going to go to the Chapel of Love and have wonderful marriages just like we've expected of them in the past, of committed unions, et cetera. Well, Andrew Kaminsky, thank you for joining the show.
Well, you're welcome, Andrew. So great to hear from you again.
Well, just starting out, introduce yourself a little bit to our listeners and describe your background on concerning these issues.
Yeah, so grew up in California, aware of having some same-sex tendencies, began to act out on those in my teenage, young adult years, and then just kind of had a spiritual reckoning with all of that, where even beyond the psychological and emotional implications of homosexuality, I think I had a moral crisis and a turning point through the Holy Spirit and faithful Christians that loved me and stood with me, but that were truthful to me as well. And the effect of all of this was turning towards Jesus and a walking with him for still up till today in the process of becoming a whole man, an integrated masculine being, which was always his destiny for me. So the impact of all of that, I'm now a married man, happily married to a woman. Sadly, we have to specify that today, which is truly ridiculous because the only meaning of marriage is man for woman, woman for man, for the purpose of uniting two different persons into a whole so that the potential for children and caring for them and dignifying them with a man and a woman working hard at it can possibly happen. I've experienced that over the course of my life. And of course, this has completely shaped my lens through which I have looked at the last 50-year devolution in regards to human rights consciousness, which has now resulted in this horrific Disrespect Marriage Act that we see. And obviously I have a whole different take on that. Sadly, it's a minority opinion, but I would wager to say it is the opinion that makes sense. Obviously, our bodies tell us the truth about the trajectory for maturing into whole people, men and women. And that has to do with man for woman and woman for man. And when we feel otherwise, there's obviously something disordered at work that our wonderful Jesus, creator, redeemer, has a commitment to helping us out with, to go from disorder to order. And the truth is, he frees us for a whole enough, ordered enough way forward for offering our sexual gift. And gratefully, that excludes same-sex relationships, morphing into this marriage reality. So that's my story, Andrew. Sticking to it. It's been a long haul, and it's been a great adventure. And I'm so happy to have opportunity to share the good news of what Jesus frees us for, not just from horrific sins, but it's for what our bodies tell us the truth about. And that is evidently that we learn how to grow and dignify the opposite gender, whatever our starting point is.
Yeah, that's an interesting story. And, of course, there's more about this at your Desert Streams Ministries website online. One thing, I guess, in talking about the whole issue of marriage, something that's been discussed in the past, do homosexual relationships, do they remain committed? Are they typically of long duration? I mean, you're coming out of this background of sort of this ex-gay background. Why or why not? What does that mean for me?
Yeah. I certainly can't speak for all same-gender friendships that become sexualized and how monogamous or not they are. I think it's clear that two men together or two women together are not operating in a duality or a complementarity where the one is kind of fulfilling or completing or provoking the other, which I think does make for a greater chance of fidelity. Now, if we use that argument as the basis, we're going to get into some difficulties, I think, because obviously there's so many heterosexual relationships that are unfaithful and disordered. And so we can't quite argue that just because it's a man and a woman together, that ensures fidelity. But I would say there is something, as I've already said, disordered about two men and two women sexualizing their relationship. And so I think that begets more disorder ultimately. I would also dare add, and I'm not really speaking for the women here, but with two men, very focused sexual beings, trying to come together and to remain faithful, I think there's a fault line there because, you know, you're already breaking out of moral order with same gender sexual relationships. And so there seems built into that to be a kind of an openness to, well, I'm with you, but I'm also open to other expressions. And so why not? Because we've already, in a sense, broken a boundary. Who are we to judge that we can't make this essentially an open relationship, sexually speaking? And I dare say when a man and a woman faithfully come together and say, we're going to make this work, and I'm accountable to you and you're accountable to me as to what we're doing in our bodies outside of this relationship, I think there's something built in to that kind of a commitment which lends itself to fidelity. So I think that's important. It's obviously important when we're open to life and we beget children, and the children need to know that their mom and dad, the promises they made with their bodies to each other, they're going to keep them. And that builds in a generational wholeness that inclines kids to want to aspire to that. So, yeah, that's where I think a committed man for a committed woman is simply the best for all persons concerned.
Yeah, there was a recent article put out by the Family Research Council at their Washington Stand website, a commentary talking about studies, recent studies that have been done that once again sort of demonstrated that many of these homosexual relationships, I mean, as you know, Andrew Solomon argued way back with his books like Virtually Normal that homosexual relationships would sort of be monogamous, he called it, that, you know, even in those relationships where people say we're committed to each other and we live together for a long time, you know, they're invariably always so-called open relationships where the individuals say, look, you know, we can go out and have sexual encounters with others. You know, I remember reading recently, I guess about a couple of months ago, my mother sent me a Washington Post Sunday magazine, and they used to have their date lab section in there, which they're discontinuing, or I guess they're discontinuing the entire Sunday magazine. You know, it was describing this one guy on a date with another guy. He talked about his past relationships. He had a so-called seven-year marriage with another guy but was then divorced. So, you know, that doesn't strike me as really, you know, much, you know, long-lasting committed relationships. I mean, I guess another follow-on question is, do you find that among homosexual communities, is there actually any great desire for such relationships? I mean, one thing that I've heard is that, you know, there actually isn't that much interest in any such idea of a marriage, of same-sex marriage. It's really more just, you know, an agenda to get approval for homosexuality in general, but de facto in practice, you know, most gays, most homosexuals, they're not really interested in any such institution that we would call marriage.
Yeah. I mean, I would say they're interested in marriage from the standpoint, yes, of normalizing their life and what they want relationally, have it recognized by the culture. There's obviously tax benefits in that as well, and a host of benefits that marriage is given legally. But I would say I go back to the issue of monogamy. Is there a commitment to when we join together in, you know, the ways that two men and two women do, is that binding? You know, I think that is not the value. The value is not that I'm actually offering myself to one person and I'm closing the door on offering my body to any other person. I think that is not a high value. And so if as Christians we take seriously what the binding nature of two bodies coming together is about, and I think this whole question and the challenge of the Defense of Marriage Act or whatever it is, the Respect Marriage Act, I think it's about saying, is my promise binding with my body? And I think as Christians, we simply have to land on, yes, gosh, what a challenge in the age of pornography, in the age of serial monogamy, in the age of no-fault divorce. You know, these are not just homosexual questions. These are fidelity questions. I think we would all have to say, wow, we may even have a kind of a Christian minority optimism about it, but I think the reality of it is we are all challenged by the fact that we are not a faithful people. And I think the best real defense of marriage is in those of us who have been audacious enough to say, when I say I do to you with my body, that's for life. That's for life. And I'm going to have to work hard and fight hard to be true to that. I think that's our authority, not just, you know, the Judeo-Christian tradition is. Yes, we know what that tradition is. It's fleshing it out by remaining gloriously faithful to one person. And I think that is uniquely the domain of serious Christian marriages. And I think that is our authority to say that is actually the best, one of the best gifts we can offer our culture. And so we do well to shudder and to be greatly dismayed at the redefining of marriage by a people group that really don't have that as a value in their sort of morphed version of marriage. And that's a real concern of mine. And it's a concern of mine for generations to come. And it's not just about being nice to our, you know, the two men that live next door to us. You know, the best way we can be kind to those men is to love them as best we can into the kingdom of God, but not to agree with the deception that just because they can go to the city hall and get a license, that means we're agreeing that they're married. You know, I have this conversation all the time with my good friends, many of whom are Catholic or evangelicals or whatever. And, you know, they love the Lord and they know the truth and they perhaps are trying to live that themselves. But when it comes to being in the world, on their jobs, in their neighborhoods, et cetera, they're compromised. And they refer to, you know, the two women that they love being married and so on and so forth. And I just stop them and say, wait a minute, these are two women who are friends and we may not agree with what they choose to do morally, but they are not married. You know, they may claim to be, they may claim to have a license, but actually as a Christian, as Christians, we say that marriage belongs to God first and foremost. God ordained marriage. Caesar didn't ordain it. And so it's up to us, seriously, to ensure that the proper definition is upheld, you know, regardless of which political bodies are saying otherwise. And I'm just super clear on that. And I think it's the most loving and truthful way that we can proceed on in this rather dreadful age of redefining marriage.
You're talking about lesbians there, an example. I guess that brings up one issue. Are there differences, you know, you're talking about the complementarity, you know, of a man with a woman. Mm-hmm. Are there differences, any mm-hmm. fundamental differences between male same-sex relationships and female lesbian same-sex relationships? I mean, that would flesh out, I guess, you know, how this is really not marriage here with same-sex attracted individuals.
Yeah. No, I would say there are significant differences because you're, you know, both being disordered in that they can never achieve the ends for which they're coming together, sexually speaking. There's no new life. There's no children that can come about except through sort of contorting adoption and so on and so forth. But I would say... yeah, I mean, you do see something essentially female two or three times over with two women. So what we might ascribe more to women than men is going to be sort of, you know, on steroids in a lesbian relationship. And similarly with men, you know, the differences in male and female sexuality are on full display in lesbianism as opposed to male homosexuality. So it is a little bit of a window of in truth, how different we are as men and women. And that's kind of ratcheted up when one seeks to, you know, kind of burrow oneself in the arms of a member of the same gender. So, yeah, I think there are significant differences between them.
Well, I guess, you know, one difference that's been commented on is that, again, as we're indicating, that male relationships, I mean, precisely because men tend to have naturally a more promiscuous sexuality, you know, those relationships tend to be really promiscuous, although I've seen studies that indicate that even lesbian relationships, for various reasons, are actually often shorter-lived, shorter in duration than male homosexual relationships. One thing I guess this brings out, you know, we talk about nature and so forth, is that it's sort of a bridge over to, you know, cross-dressing and now transgenderism. I think back to an article I wrote for Jihad Watch and the Left column talking about James Zogby, this leading progressive sort of Democratic Party political activist who is involved with Jesse Jackson's presidential campaigns in the past. His daughter is actually a lesbian activist and has one of these, as she calls it, same-sex marriage to another woman. And in the various interviews that she and her partner, her so-called wife, have given, her partner has talked about how James Zogby's daughter, Mayor Zogby, is more male appearing. I mean, she's really sort of masculine, or she practices what's been called a butch aesthetic, so-called, whereas the other woman is much more, in her dress, much more, female appearing. I mean, in their wedding photos that they posted online, so-called, Mayor Zogby's wearing like this sort of like business suit or such, and the other woman's wearing like this white wedding dress, and then they've through artificial insemination they've had two kids and so forth. Is this then sort of all sorts of gender bending stuff, and that this then leads to precisely now so-called Rachel Levine, that you've got transgenderism and cross dressing and such?
I think maybe what you're referring to, well, I'd say two things about that. First of all, I think there are different expressions of male and female homosexuality, and we can talk about sort of archetypes of that, the more butch woman and the feminine woman, or the same with the guys. And so there are variations on that for sure, and, sort of different ways and dances of attraction and desire on the spectrum. I think it is a spectrum, meaning that even if two men appear sort of very normal and sort of nice men do kind of a thing, even if it's not very exotic and they sort of keep to themselves and whatever, it's still a disordered relationship. So whether it's flamboyant and leather-bound and all over the place parading about, or whether it's sort of the quiet Republican professional, we're seeing much of this now. We're seeing a huge move in the Republican Party to say, yes, even good conservatives do this, So we're not just talking about left and right. We're just talking about the normalizing of disorder. And with this on the spectrum, of course, if I can say, gosh, I'm a pretty good person, I'm a pretty nice, responsible citizen, I've had same-sex attraction for a while, I now have met a special friend, and we're not quite faithful, but we're making it work as best we can. If that's okay, if I can say, yes, the culture has to acknowledge and bless my self-definition as a homosexual, I'm self-defining there. No one is saying I have to assume that identification, but I am, and now I'm insisting on a place, a space, a realm of influence in the culture. So if that can occur for a same-sex attracted person, there's really little basis then for saying, well, not only do I have same-sex attraction, but I actually am so at odds with my masculine self. I'm not sure if I don't want to explore my whole feminine side. Maybe I actually am a woman, and maybe I'm going to go to a counselor who's going to help me realize that I'm actually living a lie for remaining a masculine being. I'm going to effort to actually become a feminine one. So my point being that if we make room for anything other than I'm a man, I'm a woman, I've got to work that out. I've got to work that out in light of my being a disintegrated person. That's one thing I speak of throughout my book, is that we're all disintegrated people. So we're not just talking about homosexuality or trans as sort of the lunatic fringe of disintegration. We're simply saying we're all disintegrated, and we all are moral beings, as human beings, who are responsible for reckoning with the witness of our bodies. And that doesn't mean we all get married, we all live happily ever after with grandkids and this and that. It simply means we are responsible for stewarding the dignity of our sexuality and for living that out responsibly within the blessings and, you know, what are the limits for all of us of our integration as men and women. But the fact that we can work and live that out with integrity and honor and dignify the opposite gender in how we love them, how we restrain ourselves, how we initiate our gift, whether or not it's received or not, that to me is the glorious rediscovery of our lost fullness. That's my whole point. We can rediscover our lost fullness. And we have lost it. We've all lost it to some degree. We all live east of Eden. But what we're seeing now is a kind of it's an out-of-control thing. And I think people are waking up to this and saying, this is out of control. Holiday trans parades, all ages welcome in little towns in Texas. There were two small towns in Texas where the Chamber of Commerce or the City Hall, whatever it was, sort of overturned the will of the citizens and insisted on a drag show in the holiday parade. And they made the case that, well, there are kids who are really confused out there and they need to see adults acting badly in these distorted, grotesque, opposite gender caricatures. They really need to see adults doing this at a Christmas parade so that they can know that there is a way forward for their confused lives. I mean, it's insanity. It's insanity. And, you know, I think much of this started in the 60s with the Stonewall Revolution. And yes, people should not be hated and criminalized, I think, because they have same-sex attraction or whatever. But when that then becomes a turnaround and I'm insisting that my status be recognized on par with an ethnic status, I say, wait a minute. We're not talking the same things. Ethnicity is God-given, is blessed. We need to champion our different ethnicities. But sexual identity, variations, deviations, honestly, we need therapists. We need spiritual directors. We need recovery groups. We need supportive Christian community. We do not need the morphing of our human rights reality in America. And that's exactly what we're seeing. So we have sown to the wind and we are reaping a whirlwind, sexually speaking, today. And we need to take back our ground as Christians and say, well, I'm in this culture. I'm not crazy about all the decisions being made. But as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. And as for the realm of my influence and my church and my diocese and my community and my workspace, I'm going to be faithful to Jesus and the dignity of what it means to be male and female made in his image.
Well, you talk about, you know, these behaviors as manifesting insanity. You know, one thing I've heard about with same-sex relationships is that they often involve a lot of conflict, actually, indeed a lot of sort of domestic abuse. Judging on the basis of your experience and what you've experienced dealing with other people with same-sex attractions, I mean, does homosexuality ultimately make people happy? I mean, is it really gay, or is this, as you're indicating, is it really ultimately personally unfulfilling, so it really is emotionally, spiritually a dead end, and so that's all the more reason not to try to advocate for this, you know, to try to call this marriage and to sanctify it.
Yeah, exactly. I think we can say that anything that is at core disordered, and it cannot find an order. I mean, you can say it as simply as God cannot bless this. He will never bless this He will never bless the sexualization of a same-gender friendship because sex is all about the coming together of two people created differently from each other for the purpose of being open to creating new life. That's the bottom line. So that's what makes for happiness. What is ordered makes for happiness. So to bless disorder in the hopes that, oh, I just don't want you to kill yourself. I just want you to be happy. I just want you to come home for Christmas. So I'll bless it, you know. That's okay. You can do that. You can placate. You can be codependent, whatever you want to call it. But it's not going to make that other person happy. It's not going to make them happy because what is disordered creates unhappiness ultimately. Now, where I think at times we have fallen short as a Christian people is that we have not upheld the hope that Jesus can transform you. Jesus can help you. You can get back on this track towards integration. Like, let's do it. It's not just repenting from acts that bring you into the hellfire. It's about getting on with the business of what you were made for. And I think we as a church have been pretty muffled about the hope of Jesus Christ and the hope of the Christian community and giving people a fighting chance to say, I want to do this over again. I want to do it better. I didn't know there was an opportunity. I didn't know of that in the rainbow, advocates that came through in my sixth grade and said, hey, you can go to the Rainbow Club now, you know. I didn't know there was anything other than I guess that's kind of just who I am, you know. So as Christians, I think we have some repenting to do in regards to our becoming worldly and not actually offering persons the hope that repentance actually means getting on with the business of living a happy and fulfilled life. And that's certainly what I have discovered. That's what we do at Desert Stream. By the way, it's desertstreamoneword.org. So if you want to find out more about what we do and equipping churches and parishes and dioceses to be hopeful communities, yes, we all need to repent of our fake solutions and buying into idolatrous, cultural norms that have nothing to do with Christianity, like the Respect Marriage Act. We can turn from all of that, and we need to, because these things are pressing and they're ever before us, and they offer a solution that keeps us unhappy. So the best thing that we can do is to know this hope and to be agents of good news for persons around us. I mean, they may not want the good news. They may think we're crazy, but that's why Stephen was martyred. That's why the church values the witness of those who stand against the culture and are often stoned for it. But we go down happy the way Stephen went down. And I'm committed to that all my days. So the fact that we are now an annoying minority may just be the best thing that the church needs today for us to be able to find our footing and to be authentically countercultural as the early Christians were.
Well, talking about children, you've mentioned, all these, drag events and so forth around the country in places like Texas. Yeah. I mean, isn't that this, promotion of homosexuality and, same-sex marriage, is this also just simply a form of grooming? I mean, now we're going to have, like Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg and his partner, they've gone through these processes of getting a surrogate mother and, raising kids. So now kids are going to be raised precisely in this milieu of homosexuality. Yeah. Is this not indeed grooming that you're going to be exposing kids to this now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and not just exposing them through adoption or, surrogates or whatever, but just in social influence. So whether it's the imminence of being a part of a, quote, gay family or whatever, or whether it's just what we're watching on television and what our teachers are saying, and you know, just the it's just a fake liberty, a fake good news that's being upheld based upon, and what's often used is that, well, these are vulnerable people, and if we don't give them what they want, they're going to kill themselves. So the best thing we can do for their mental well-being, at least, is to sort of give them what they want. And I just think we have to have a longer-range view and again, uphold the hope. Uphold the hope. And, you know, I would ask you, Andrew, you know, you're a faithful man. When was the last time you heard in your church of a man or a woman that came up and said, you know, I'm going to tell you all how Jesus transformed my life. I used to be gay identified, but now I'm actually making peace with my masculinity through this church. This church has been a life-saving, giving community for me. You know, until we hear that a lot, then how can we counter the cultural fake news, the fake good news of coming out and now I'm finally free to be me and I finally have my place in the drag parade, you know? I mean, we need to hear, we need witnesses and we need courageous gatekeepers in our communities to say, okay, come on, bring on the good news then. Because if all we're doing as a church is saying, oh, I can't believe they're grooming people. I can't believe Nancy Pelosi. I can't believe Joe Biden. It's like, well, believe. They're here, and they have the power. But there's a greater power in our faith. And to what degree is our faith a clarion call of what happens when Jesus gets a hold of a person that's been in great disorder and who in Jesus' mercy is now free to even say that. Say, yeah, I was in such darkness. To hear Pete Buttigieg say, you know what? I was so deceived. I was just in darkness. Sorry, you know? I love that. I mean, that's what I'm gunning for. I'm gunning for a minority of people to come to their senses through the Holy Spirit and to lead many people with them on the trail of transformation. So that's what I'm about, bro. That's what my life's about. I mean, I stay in my lane. I don't do everything. I'm not really even a politico, but of course I'm alarmed by what's going on in the culture. But where that directs me is to say, what am I doing to make it clear to people the real choice Jesus Christ is giving them to discover this lost fullness. So that's what I'm hoping will be the fruit of my life anyway.
Well, you mentioned this issue of, you know, people raise this concern of, well, if we don't affirm people's homosexuality, you know, they'll get depressed and commit suicide. But, you know, I've looked at, you know, there have been studies done of, like, places like Holland and so forth, which are the, you know, been long-standing sort of affirming cultures of homosexuality. And they're apparently, you know, suicide rates among same-sex identified, same-sex attracted individuals aren't, you know, haven't improved or aren't any better. So, again, you know, does affirmation ultimately lead to happiness?
No, exactly. It does not. I think that's just a given. And sadly, we are creating in our culture people who are just so vulnerable to falsely identifying as trans, as gay, the whole LGBTQ spectrum, are people in search of a self, in search of an identity. Sadly created a monster, which doesn't mean people are monsters. That's important. We're not saying people are monstrous. We're simply saying that it is a monstrous solution to say, oh, find yourself on this spectrum. Find yourself in the sort of ever-changing alphabet soup of a new fractured self. That's kind of a ticket to a prolonged and torturous adolescence where I never land. I mean, that's one of the main developmental tasks of adolescence, is coming out of that self-focus and who am I, and, you know, every mirror is horrific because it portrays me, and I'm always trying to doctor myself up and to become better for the mirror. Well, I think the LGBTQ mirror is just that. It's inviting people into a prolonged self-focus where you never land because you're never in reality. I'm never in reality when I'm in my gay self. I'm never in reality when I'm in my opposite gender identification, my trans self, or when I'm experimenting or I'm cross-dressing, but I still am sort of a man, or, you know, whatever the variance is, it's all a prolonged adolescence. I've not yet landed. And where we have to land is on the secure enough. I say secure enough. I'm not talking perfection. I'm not talking no conflict. It's all about conflict. We're all in conflict. But the way we resolve that conflict is by saying, I'm actually settling on the fact that I was born a woman and I've got to make peace with that. And actually sexing it up with another woman distorts that. So maybe I just need to sober up a little and just learn who I am in Jesus Christ, you know. And same with guys. It's very different. Men and women are different. But it's what leads to life. And it's a part of growing up. It's a part of discipleship. It's a part of knowing and loving this Jesus who's nearer than a brother to us. And, yeah.
Well, you've discussed before, I was looking at some past presentations you've done, and, you know, when the whole 2015 Obergefell decision of the Supreme Court came down, you know, you talked about how Americans live in a gay marriage nation now. What then is the possibility, or I guess, you know, ultimately many would say it's impossible. You know, how are any dissenters to this sexual revolution, to this LGBT movement, going to survive in society? I mean, how can you send children to, you know, Sunday school where they learn about biblical and natural law morality, as you're discussing, but then they're going to receive a contrary indoctrination in, say, public schools and elsewhere throughout the rest of the week? What should be done there? And I mean, isn't it just a farce, as people are talking about with this whole Respect for Marriage Act, that, oh, yeah, we're going to respect religious liberty?
Yeah, no, that is a concern of mine, and I'm not expert enough to say how great of a threat this is to religious liberty. I simply do know of the conflicts that families face, faithful, Christian, evangelical, and Catholic families who are so devoted to their children and their, you know, their children's best futures in regards to sexual integration and wholeness. And then this culture clash that occurs when, you know, the kid comes home. Of course, I hope only or primarily from a public school. Hope it's not a Catholic school. And you know, Jimmy is now introduced as Judy, and the way that we love is by recognizing that Jimmy is now, and he's not no longer Judy, and, you know, and that's all framed as love. It's all framed as we are doing the most loving thing by blessing now, you know, this shift. And it wreaks havoc on a kid's value set, because here are their parents telling them one thing, and then maybe a very sweet and compassionate teacher, and they want to be embraced by the teacher and blessed, and, you know, so there's this value clash between LGBTQ training in schools and what Christian parents believe. And so I think at the very least, regardless of whether one has the resources to go to parochial school or not, I think it's about discovering one today has to be actively engaged with one's children in a very, I think the best resources are sort of, you know, theology of the body for kids. You know, St. John Paul II's amazing tome on sexual love, probably really the best thing that's out there, but it's a pretty complicated, dense, you know, book. And, Christopher West out of the Theology of the Body Institute in Lancaster, PA, has done such a marvelous job at adapting John Paul's great prophetic work. It's just beautiful. It's so life-giving and affirming. And the best thing parents can do is to get some handles as to how to talk with their kids in such a constructive way about sexual love, and appropriately for children, in such a way that is an antidote against all this like craziness, and to simply arm our children with the beauty of what it means to be man for woman, woman for man, girl for boy, boy for girl, again, appropriate to age. And on that basis, to have something positive, which is, you know, the best offense in the face of distorted, destructive teaching. So I do think, whether we like it or not, that parents cannot take for granted that their children are not being influenced. They are being influenced. And I think that we need to man and woman up as parents and be the first to lead out with the good news, so that kids have something really substantial with which to navigate this distortion that's everywhere, even if one is not getting this explicitly taught to them. It's being taught on computer screens and films and TV shows and, yeah, peer relations. And so, yeah, our kids need to be equipped. They just do.
Well, yeah, you talk about this entire social transformation. How has this LGBT movement been so successful? I mean, how have conservatives failed on, you know, what was in the past, upholding what was, you know, throughout history has been considered normal mores, normal standards, and, you know, indeed, you know, for about, say, a decade ago or so was actually a very a successful, politically winning issue. I mean, George W. Bush, for example, in 2004, it's often credited in places like Ohio and elsewhere that, you know, this whole defense of marriage, the definition of marriage as a man-woman institution was really a decisive political issue.
Right. No, that's a great point. And as you say, that's not even 20 years ago. You know, that's 15 years ago, 18 years ago. It's not just, the good old days, some mythical, you know, 19th century thing. This is very recent history. You're right. So I don't know all the reasons for it for sure, brother. I can't pretend to know that. I do think, tend to think our divorce culture, the fact that, you know, divorce is such a common way of resolving marital difficulties. I have to think we have to take some ownership that even though we've believed in the institution, we've not fleshed it out well. And so I think our failure to uphold marriage, our own marriages, contributes, because I think if you believe the truth, but you've faltered and you've not been able to live it, I think that naturally opens you to saying, well, who am I to judge? Who am I to say, you know, Ben and Bob, you know, who am I to say? I mean, look at Bill Clinton was the first one to extend this mantle, and look at his life, and God bless him. I mean, he was a sex addict. He just couldn't stay out of the bed of beautiful women. Over and over and over again, you know, Hillary would concur. And he was the first one to say, well, really, who am I to judge? Why not? You know, so he was the first one with Ellen and you know, Anne Heche and, you know, these, you know, sexy blonde women, you know, up with him, up the podium. You know, it was just natural. It was unnaturally natural, you know, that he would be the first to say, well, I can't do it. I can't be true. So why shouldn't your truth have equal sway? So I think we have to look at something like that. I look at that seriously. I'm not saying it's the answer, but I think it is a contributor. In other words, it's like saying, oh, well, that priest who was, you know, banging around with teens or whatever, he's really orthodox. I mean, he really loves, he's a traditionalist. It's like, well, you can be a traditionalist and be a mess and keep it to yourself, but still leave a trail, you know, moral depravity that actually weakens the fabric of a church, of a community, of a nation. And so I'm all about, are we living the truth that we revere? And if we are, then I think we have a voice and a platform that will endure. Even if it's a minority voice, God will still breathe on it and give us influence. So that's kind of how I see it.
Well, one thing, do you think that conservatives, I've heard this before among some that, that at least in the past, like in the battle over marriage, there were sort of political talking points that went out or various institutions saying that we would stay away from discussing sort of homosexuality's darker, seedier sides. I mean, has that been the case and is therefore, you know, so-called winsomeness not working on this issue?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I agree with that. I mean, I think, yeah, I guess a risk, and it's probably getting riskier, you know, people that, you know, don't, maybe there are lots of people that, you know, whose primary struggles are not sexual. They've been faithful, whether they're single or married. You know, they've been comparatively chaste, you know. But, you know, they see this cultural battle and it's like, oh, what's going on, you know. And I think for some people, maybe especially men, I think it may be more the domain of men than women. It's kind of like, oh, this gay thing or, oh, this queer thing. It's like it kind of makes me sick. You know, it's just sickening to me. And now you could say, well, there's a righteous indignation. There is that. But I think there's also a disgust that is somewhat pharisaic. It's more the traditions of men. It's just kind of my lack like that. I don't even get that. That's just too much. You know, so I think there is a way in which our disagreement, our saying, no, that's disordered, that is not God's will. I think we have to work really hard to keep it, to keep God's heart in it, which is always for the person. Now, I think that involves saying, yeah, that is disordered and that is hurtful to the person and to those whom he will influence. That troubles me. And so I am going to do everything I can to not allow that to pervade my little piece of the universe, if you will. So I think we, in our disagreement, we need to be true. We need to plow a deep furrow of what is good and right and beautiful. And that is, those are never LGBTQ solutions. But we need to do it with a real love of the human beings involved. Now, if that has at times resulted in kowtowing and, you know, the sacred cow of the poor gay person, and we need, you know, we're sort of pandering. When that's the case, we need to repent and just say, oh, I'm pandering now. Like, what am I doing, you know? At the same time, in rectifying that tendency to pander and people please, we also don't want to fall back into disgust, because I think that, it, you know, sort of, you know, the angry person yelling in the streets against something, I think that goes nowhere, honestly. And I think it reinforces a vision of Christian truth as being only prohibitive and never really about the good of the whole person, which involves a prohibition. But more than that, it involves a yes to what Jesus has for him or her if he or she were to turn from what is a dead end. And that's where I always seek to land over and over again after, you know, many, many years on this trajectory.
Well, you know, you've talked a lot about, you know, precisely the human body, you know, the reality of our bodies. I mean, this is a very, indeed, a natural law approach to issues of marriage. Mm-hmm. How should that affect the movement in discussing this? I mean, I think about how should, say, Christians interact with non-Christians. You think about, like, you know, Muslim parents in Dearborn, Michigan recently were outraged at what, you know, all these pro-LGBT books they saw in the school library there. I mean, isn't that then what is really needed in dealing with this, that we need to move beyond just any particular theological, you know, Christian, biblical base, and to discuss these issues in a natural law manner that unites all people, you know, Muslims, Jews, whatever, atheists for that matter, to analyze these issues rationally?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I totally agree with that. And I think that is the beauty of natural law. It's the beauty of our theological anthropology, which applies to all people. So just because it's theological doesn't mean it doesn't apply to all. It simply means we need to deal with the human creature, not just the Christian creature. And I totally agree with that, and that's where I believe the Imago Dei, just being created to represent God, and what we know of that fundamentally is that it's in the duality of how we work out our lives, man to woman, woman to man. That alone gives us level ground with all persons. And I think, especially with parents, when you do come together, whether you're Christian or not, and you begin to have children, and you begin to care about, well, what about my kids? You know, where are they going to be in all this? I think it does begin to raise important questions to parents that maybe in their individual single lives they were a little more laissez-faire about. And then it's like, oh, wait, do I want that for my kid? And I've had so many conversations with parents, some of whom were, you know, maybe lapsed Christians or becoming Christians, not necessarily cradle or, you know, not even that converted, but at the point of their kids beginning to go AWOL in the LGBTQ world, I think it's almost like, wait a minute, I was so embracing of this in my, you know, sort of progressive 20s or whatever the case might be. And now I'm like, no, I actually, honestly, don't want that for my child. You know, when you start actually seeing the impact of the unhappiness of being somewhat stalled in one's sexual becoming, you know, I think it is converting, even if it doesn't go by a specific religious name. But you begin to say, wait, I want more for my kid. And I mean, what a blessing a parent is when he or she has that higher vision and that doesn't just in sort of placating or ultimate weariness, poor single parents, you know, just kind of concedes and says, oh, well, yeah, that's who you are, I guess, you know. You know, how much more holy and robust for a parent to say, no, I actually wanted more for you. And, you know, I'm praying for that. I'm hoping for that. I want to engage with you about that so that at least some persons of influence are upholding a truer, more fruitful vision for the loved one's life And that's always my hope. And we encourage parents accordingly, even as I, as a parent, have encouraged my children.
All right, then. Well, for our listeners out there, you've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we've been discussing about the recently enacted Respect for Marriage Act passed into law by President Joe Biden, or signed into law by President Joe Biden last December 13th. And we've been discussing the fallout from this decision and the revolution in our culture, our marriage culture and sexual mores, with Andrew Kominski, who is a leader at Desert Stream Ministries. You can find him online in the ex-gay movement, and is an author of the insightful Sophia Institute Press book, Rediscovering Our Lost Fullness, A Guide to Sexual Integration. Well, Andrew Kominski, thank you for joining the show.
Oh, thank you, Andrew. I'm so happy that you thought of me again, and I hope we'll talk more in the future.
Yes, it's been very insightful. And for our listeners out there, tune in next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.
Bless you, Andrew. Thank you so much.